Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, day 11 of Wimbledon Relived, what would have been women's semi-finals day at Wimbledon and would probably have been under the roof because looking out of my window in Putney, which is a mere mile and a half-ish down the road from SW19, is blooming miserable. So that's great. Thank you, British Weather, for making summer 2020 just that little bit extra great. But not to worry, because I've got David and Matt to talk tennis with. And it's our 700th episode, David, you just told me. We actually can mark a milestone because we've remembered it before recording rather than 4 seconds after recording.
Yeah, we've celebrated 501 and 601 in the past. I'm feeling quite proud. You know, it jars me when you say it's women's semi-finals day today, because I'd forgotten that, in as much as I'm so used to now talking about classic matches with you both, watching them. We've just watched another one. The BBC have got matches on every day that they're showing. Wimbledon are doing their own stuff online, streaming matches, which, you know, is the one good thing I take from this whole period, is that suddenly this vast archive is just being put out there for everybody to enjoy. But I had actually forgotten that it is still Wimbledon and that today would have been women's semi-finals day, and that makes me quite sad. Yeah,
I wish I could forget. I get the impression, Matt, that perhaps you haven't forgotten in the optimistic every cloud silver lining way that David has.
I don't know, I kind of have in a way. I'm just so invested in what we're doing that the usual schedule of Wimbledon isn't really in my mind so much.
Just me then. Okay. Today we're taking a trip back to 2005 when Lance Armstrong was winning his seventh consecutive Tour de France title. The A380 made its first flight. The Live 8 concerts were held. Good friend of mine went to Live 8 in Hyde Park, and she says it was mostly great until Sting came on early evening when everyone was pissed and in party mode and sung new material.
Do you know Live 8 is when I discovered Pink Floyd and realised I liked it?
In the year 2005, David Law discovered Pink Floyd.
Yeah, and Matt's now sort of got me to realise that I actually need to listen to albums full of Bruce Springsteen and not just judge him on We Are the World and Born in the USA.
Correct. Get on that, David. It was also the year that Britain implemented the Civil Partnerships Act to include same-sex partnerships. It was the year that London won the rights to host the 2012 Olympics. And the Xbox 360 was released. Oh, and Pope John Paul II died. We've already done a 2005 match at the French Open, so those are events that we didn't mention first time around. So that was 2005. I was working my first Wimbledon as an employee. I was a ball store assistant under the employ of one Derek Dimmer, who was the head of the ball store at Wimbledon and had done that job with his wife for, what, centuries, I think. it was a job which largely comprised heavy lifting, and I loved it. I couldn't believe my luck that I was working at Wimbledon, even though my primary job was lifting boxes of tennis balls and wandering around the Arangi practice courts with a bin bag, asking players and coaches if I could collect their used balls after practice so they could be resold to charity. I thought that was the best job in the world, and I could not believe my luck. And I went back the next year as head ball store assistant.
I was going to say, you were soon to be promoted.
Yeah, that was my first promotion. And that
I was going to ask if you did a good job and whether you got a good review. Turns out you did.
Turns out I did. I mean, there's only so much that can go wrong with putting balls in a bin bag. But it didn't go wrong. And honestly, I thought asking Tim Henman if he was finished with his tennis balls, I just thought that was the coolest thing in the world. I thought I was the coolest person in the world for getting to do that job. So I think I watched this women's final, certainly followed it from the Arangi practice courts, from what I can remember. I'm not sure I was able to sit and watch the whole thing because I had very important duties to be carrying out. But I was certainly at Wimbledon at the time and remembered the building atmosphere as the match progressed and a feeling spreading around the grounds of this is a special one here. This is a special final that's developing. You were at Wimbledon as well, David.
Yeah, I think I would have been doing not flash interviews, but interviews on the sort of player lawn that they have, this area that all the players and their families and their entourages congregate between matches. And when you get to that final weekend, it's a pretty deserted place because there just aren't many players left. You've got the doubles teams that are left in the finals, the mixed doubles teams, the wheelchair players, the juniors, and a couple of singles finalists. And yes, a lot of people around them because a lot of people will fly in. You've got a lot of celebrities milling around that come for the big occasion. My job would have been to get reaction, to try to doorstep people. And I do quite like doorstepping people. It's quite good fun for live interviews. Although occasionally you can go up and say, yeah, come to me live now. I can see so-and-so. I'm just about to go and ask them. And you ask them and they say, no, I don't think so. Don't want to speak to you, which doesn't go down so well. But in terms of because of that, I don't remember actually watching this tennis match because I couldn't see it anywhere. I'm just outside on a lawn. I would have been listening to the commentary on BBC Radio as I'm waiting to go live if I get somebody to speak to. But it's been one of the real joys of doing this over the last week, and so, less so at Roland Garros because I always get to watch that because I'm never working there. But these matches, there's a bit of a blind spot for me in this period where I feel like I don't remember the matches that well. I don't even remember that many of the statistics and the title hauls and so forth. I didn't realise there were gaps in Venus Williams' CV, for instance, which we've discovered unearthing all this. But what an absolute joy to relive that match that we've just seen. Fantastic.
Hang on, what were the gaps in Venus Williams' CV?
Well, hadn't she gone 4 years without winning a Grand Slam?
Right, you mean sort of time gaps. Yeah.
And I know she's won 7 major titles. I didn't realise necessarily how they were clustered. Mm. And there was a period where she was the dominant player in the world for a couple of years. And of course, she's won 5 Wimbledons as well. But I just didn't realise there was that lull in her career in terms of winning.
I remember this period of Venus Williams' career, sort of 2005 to 2008, where she won 3 Wimbledons in 4 years. She was like this person who would just bloom during Wimbledon and then not be so good at the other slams. And she was always kind of elusive in that way. I felt as someone who, you know, this is now very much in my tennis watching memory. And you know, it was just interesting how she was so good at Wimbledon, but less dominant at the other slams. And that's something that we'll hear Lindsay Davenport talk about a bit later. But 2005 is the first first Wimbledon, and this is the sort of phrase that will disgust both of you, especially David. 2005, the first Wimbledon that I can remember. And I just remember my teacher at primary school just putting it on at lunch break just for me to sit and watch while everyone else was outside, which sounds like quite a sad scene now I tell it like that. But actually, I was really happy in those moments just watching Wimbledon at primary school on my own. That was kind of where my love for tennis was built, I think. And yeah, this Wimbledon, I do remember watching.
Have you had any of those, Catherine, where you were called Tennis Cathy, weren't mm-hmm. you, at school? Have you had any where you've sort of either
sat and watched tennis alone?
Have you ever skipped lessons? Have you ever found ways to watch tennis in circumstances where you know nobody else is doing it and it's a bit awkward, but you know you're going to do it anyway because it's that big a deal?
Yeah, well, after my A levels, so AS levels in 2003, I remember they made us go back to school post AS levels for sort of just the syllabus was over, obviously, because we'd taken our exams. And I remember there was like a 2-3 week period where they made us go back to school, and it seemed entirely pointless. So I took 2 weeks off to watch Wimbledon. I remember my parents being sort of on board with that, which was, you know, really enlightened parenting on reflection. I very much appreciate that. I remember watching the Goran Ivanisevic Pat Rafter 2001 final in the school's IT room, and they kept it open for me after school finished. It was me and a girl called Hannah Blakey. And Hannah and I were friendly, but we weren't particularly friends, but we shared that moment together. Hello, Hannah, if you're listening. Don't think she is. My teenage and university years are littered with experiences like that, because my family were tennis fans, but I didn't have any friends that were tennis fans or really even particularly sports fans. I was this curiosity. You know, I remember coming into the common room one day, I think it would have been, again, 2003 or 2004, and I was exhausted because I'd stayed up all night watching the US Open. It had been rained off all night. And I'd stayed up anyway, just in the hopes that some tennis would be played. And I remember my friends looking at me like I was an alien, saying, "You stayed up all night to watch rained off tennis." I said, "Yeah, well, obviously, when you put it like that, it makes me sound like a crazy person, but..." Yes, I did.
It's interesting how in your school and university days you would have to miss something to watch tennis. For me, I often went to the lesson but would sort of balance my phone sort of behind, like on my pencil case, so the teacher couldn't see it, and just have the match playing during the lesson or during the lecture or whatever it was, you know, whether if it was on BBC, you know, I could get that on my phone. And I've had several experiences where I've sort of accidentally yelled out in the middle of a lesson because someone's just hit a brilliant passing shot or something, and I'm sure teachers were aware of it, but I thought I was sort of getting away with it, and there was this moment of sort of danger of watching tennis in a lesson. And
this is like my brother sent me a picture yesterday of his home office setup. Yesterday was the day that cricket returned in the UK, and he had a screen set up showing the cricket, which was exactly in line with his laptop camera, so that while watching the cricket, it would appear as if he was just paying extremely close attention in Zoom meetings. How many people do you think there are across the country that have got that set up going on?
They didn't have phones when I was at school.
Well, that's what I mean.
That's what he was really gently getting at, David. He just didn't want to...
Didn't have them at university either, but there was a single common room where I do remember watching Pete Sampras against Jim Courier 1995 at the Australian Open. There was another one where I convinced a pub in Cornwall to stay open in the early hours to let me watch Greg Rusedski against Pat Rafter in the US Open final, and then there was the university lecturer who I convinced to use the college video recorder to tape the 1997 match at the Royal Albert Hall between John McEnroe and Bjorn Borg in the first ever Champions Tour event the year before I started working on it, just because I wanted to watch it. And when I joined the ATP a year later and I had no friends in my first week, I went into the office, the ATP office, at midnight on a Sunday with an entire cooked chicken, which I'd bought from a deli in the supermarket, and I had nothing else, just the chicken, and I watched Alex Kuretcher against Thomas Enquist in the Indian Wells final on my own in the middle of the night.
That is the behaviour of a madman.
And those are just four examples of many, I tell you.
That sounds like sort of Barnaby with the swords-esque behaviour.
Yeah, we haven't revealed the name Barnaby to our listeners who remember the samurai sword collection in Cornwall on the farm. But yes, hello, Barnaby. I wonder what he's doing.
I don't
doing
think
now.
Barnaby or Hannah Blakey are listening somehow. Maybe
should
they
we talk
are.
About should we talk about Lindsay Davenport yeah. and Venus Williams now?
Because it's, I think it's probably the best women's final ever. Is that? Do you think that's safe to say? I mean, it's the longest, but that doesn't necessarily mean the best. But having just watched it back, the persistently high level from both players, especially given the style of tennis they're both playing, which is pretty high risk tennis, is utterly extraordinary.
I think it's just one of those matches which speaks for itself. Like, there's no sort of iconic tiebreak or Monday finish or real aggro between the players. You know, it's all about, as you said, the sustained quality of the tennis from first ball to last, and both women coming up with their best plays on the biggest points. And, you know, it's just a joy to watch because the quality is just so high.
And yet there is also still a high wire act being performed by Venus Williams to stay in the thing. That's just, there's so much drama, but it's sustained and it just sort of keeps going all the way through the match. But you're right. I was thinking we did the Sabatini-Graf match earlier in Wimbledon Relived, and I really enjoyed that. But this was about winners. This was about never missing, just taking control one to the other. And so to have a match finishing deep in the third set, an extended third set, where there's that many winners, I'd agree. I can't think of a higher quality match that I've seen.
To fill you in on kind of the trajectory and the ebbs and flows of the match, it's Lindsay Davenport, who incidentally is the top seed at this tournament. She's the world number one at the time, although that doesn't necessarily tell the full story. We'll come on to more of that in a moment. But Davenport is, I think, 5-1 up in the opening set. She's got a double break. And it looks like it's going to be a fairly straightforward opener. And Venus just comes back at her and makes it a really competitive set, which ends up being pretty nervy in the end. Davenport just sealing it 6-4. And then in the second set, it's Davenport that breaks at 5-all and is serving for it at 6-5. And at that point, Venus Williams plays one of the all-time great games, I would say. She breaks Lindsay Davenport to love when Davenport is trying to serve out the match. And it's four winners. It's four absolute screaming winners. And she continues that form into the tiebreak. I think she wins 8 points in a row, all told. And she wins that tiebreak 7-4. And then the deciding set is just an absolute joy of back and forth, sustained top level tennis, just power hitting from the baseline, but a lot more than that as well. There's glorious use of angles and working the court and cat and mouse going on. It's an absolute just joyous display of tennis. Lindsay Davenport holds a match point, a championship point, at 6-5 in the decider. She doesn't take it, or 5-4 in the decider rather. And Venus Williams ends up clinching her third of what would be five Wimbledon titles, 9-7 in that decider, and gives us one of the all-time best winning celebrations ever. So that's what happened in the match for anybody that missed it. But obviously, those are just the facts. That doesn't tell the whole story, even partway, does it?
No. In terms of feel watching the match, two things occurred to me as it was going along. One was the sound of the ball when it's hit by Lindsay Davenport. And the only sound effect I can come up with verbally is donk. As a, you know, she hits it and it just feels like the thing is off, you know. It's an incredible sound. And I when I watch her play at that level, I often think, well, how did anybody stop that? And then you watch this match and you realize what Venus Williams is doing to diffuse that, to absorb the pace and redirect it often on the run at full stretch and turn defense into attack. And I don't think the game had ever seen anything like that before. Because, I mean, there have been wonderful athletes before, like Steffi Graf. But yes, okay, if she's on the run on the forehand, she could hit a big forehand. But she'd be hitting defensive slices or at least floating the ball back to keep in rallies, showing amazing movement. Venus is just stretching out and turning defense into attack in a way that I don't think I've seen before. And that game you described, the 4 points in a row, the look on the face of Lindsay Davenport, I don't think she'd ever faced anything like that before.
Yeah, she looked shell-shocked, didn't she? I mean, very often, and we've seen it this fortnight, haven't we? People are unsuccessful when they try and serve out the match due to nerves and their arm feeling like lead and their feet not moving properly, feeling like they're stuck in the mud. But I'm not sure Davenport even had the chance to experience any of that, because winners were sailing past her. You know, it was just, she wasn't in the game. She didn't have a chance to really try and play for the title.
And even on her championship point in the third set, Venus steps in and cracks one of those sort of inside-out backhand winners, just, you know, clean past her. You know, she doesn't have a chance to even get a racket on the ball. And I think Davenport was eight times 2 points from winning, and obviously held championship point once. You know, Venus played this match, as you said, David, on the brink throughout. She was the one having to come from behind for most of the match, and yet she still managed to play the most brilliant, bold tennis. And that idea of Venus changing the game and bringing something new to tennis is what Venus always said she would do when she was, I think, 14 on the cover of Sports Illustrated, certainly in Sports Illustrated, and said, I'm going to change the game. And I just love that she was unapologetic about what she knew she was capable of doing. And it's matches like these where you see her do it.
She was ranked outside the top 10 at this point, was Venus Williams. What was she, the 13th seed? At the tournament, she hadn't won a slam in 4 years. But Davenport herself, I said it didn't tell the full story that she was world number one. She hadn't won a slam in 5 years. And extraordinarily, at the ages of 25 for Venus and 29 for Davenport, pre-match, this was being billed as a last chance saloon for both of them. It really was. I remember that. I really do. And that's, I mean, I suppose that was fairly accurate in terms of Davenport, but in terms of Venus, who's just turned 40 and has every intention of coming back from this hiatus, is just extraordinary.
Yeah, that has moved on, hasn't it? The perception of what a tennis career span is has just totally changed, and that's only in 15 years. And I mean, and you can look at the Venus is a big part of the reason for that. Roger Federer is, Serena is, and they have changed the perception of everybody else by doing it. It's just normal now for people to think that there's no need to stop. But you're right. I mean, I actually was not really, it had passed me by that both players had gone that period of time without having won a slam.
Davenport had got into a run of losing Grand Slam semi-finals. She lost six of them between 2001 and 2004. And then at the start of the 2005 season, she reached the Australian Open final and then backed it up with this Wimbledon final. What do we know about 15-year-old Cecil Karatantcheva?
Karatantcheva.
She was the one who beat Venus Williams at Roland Garros just before this Wimbledon.
She was kind of, obviously, not in skill terms or even in results terms, but she was kind of the Coco Gauff of her time. She was the one that caused people to debate and discuss the age eligibility rules, because she broke onto the scene as a 14-year-old. And I think, if memory serves, she complained about the age eligibility rules because she wasn't allowed to play as much as she had wanted to. She ended up getting a drugs ban, didn't she?
Yeah.
And I think is no longer on the scene. But she was much hyped, though probably still not somebody that Venus should have been losing to in the third round of the French Open.
She was also quite notorious for some rather indelicate remarks she made in press conferences ahead of big matches.
Yes, please.
and she faced Wimbledon champion Maria Sharapova, I think probably in 2004, and it was quite well known at the time that she declared her intention pre-match to kick her ass off.
I'm
going to kick her ass off. I'm just telling you that's what I'm going to do. Those are the direct quotes. No. I'll see if I can find the result. It was one of those where, yeah, Catherine's right. There was a lot of hype and she was adding to it because of things she was saying like that. But yes, it didn't end up going very far.
Someone that did kick Maria Sharapova's ass off, though, I've seen the opportunity for a segue and I'm taking it, was Venus Williams, because Sharapova was the defending champion at that Wimbledon. Stop laughing at me, David. It was an excellent segue.
Karatantcheva is now 30. How has she become 30? Once reached the quarterfinals of the French Open in 2005.
Oh, so that was this year.
That's what we're talking about.
Okay. Yes. Yeah.
Right. You fall down your Karatantcheva rabbit hole, David, while I continue with my excellent segue. Because Sharapova was the defending champion in 05. We covered her 04 win yesterday, of course. And Venus beat her handily in the semi-finals, 6-1, 7-6. Competitive second set, but basically a handy victory over Sharapova. And Venus got into the final, therefore, without dropping a set, having not been talked about at all pre-tournament. It was a total surprise that she made it that far.
And there's also a very interesting thing which happens between that semi-final win over Sharapova and before her final against Davenport, which is that Venus pushes for equal prize money. She is in the offices of the All England Club the night before her final against Davenport, pushing for equal prize money. You know, it's easy. I think we can lose sight maybe now that Venus has slightly retreated from press conferences a little bit in the last few years, but she was a outspoken political voice at this time particularly. And yeah, she was lobbying for it. And a year later, she would write an article for the Times, when there still wasn't equal prize money, saying that Wimbledon sent me a message, I'm only a second-class champion. That was published in the Times. And then a year later, in 2007, there finally was equal prize money. And Venus was the first woman to earn that equal prize money for winning the title. And I just think it's very symbolic of the player and person that Venus was at the time, that she was managing all of this off court while also managing to sustain an incredibly high level on the court.
Yeah, I read about that this morning as well, Matt, and I was aware of that Grand Slam board meeting that had happened at that Wimbledon. I had no idea that it was on the eve of that final. So Venus Williams, who was on the players' board at the time and had formed a bit of an alliance, or a lot of an alliance, with the then chief executive of the WTA, Larry Scott. He had taken up his post in 2003, and he had made a point of sitting down with a lot of the prominent players, particularly Venus and Serena Williams, and talking to them about the fight for equality. And he'd said to them, look, I'm up for it. I'm up for fighting for it, but I need your help on this. I need you to be with me. And Venus in particular had said, yep, I'm up for that. And that required her to go into a room full of, well, basically men. I believe there was one other woman in the room, Jane Brown Grimes, who was a non-voting member of the USTA at the time. But otherwise, it was entirely men, this Grand Slam board. And she went into that meeting the night before her Wimbledon final. And she asked everyone at the meeting to close their eyes and to try to feel the person next to them. She asked them to reach out and grab or touch the person next to them. And she said, can you tell if that person is a man or a woman? And she said, I wanted to illustrate that all of our hearts beat the same rhythm, regardless of gender. And she later added, sort of reflecting on that, sometimes we lose track of and don't even realise our own bias and our own prejudice, and we have to confront ourselves. And obviously, that's a quote that feels particularly pertinent just at the moment. And Jane Brown Grimes, incidentally, has talked about that meeting after the event, and just how unusual it was for a player to come to one of those meetings. She said, "You just don't often get a top player at those meetings." And she said Venus sort of kept them all waiting in the hall before coming in. It was a real sort of grand entrance. And Larry Scott, reflecting on that meeting as well, said it was one of the most stunning, poignant, powerful moments I've ever experienced in a business meeting. And yet still, Wimbledon didn't offer equal prize money. They closed the gap a little. By this point, the gap in pay was less than 10%. But Venus and Larry Scott and everybody else involved said, no, that's not good enough. And as you say, Matt, it was in 2006 that Venus wrote what ended up going viral, this op-ed piece for the Times, or the Times of London, as Americans call it. It's just the Times, folks. A few excerpts from that the following year. She said, I feel so strongly that Wimbledon's stance devalues the principle of meritocracy and diminishes the years of hard work that women on the tour have put into becoming professional tennis players. I believe that athletes, especially female athletes in the world's leading sport for women, should serve as role models. The message I like to convey to women and girls across the globe is that there is no glass ceiling. My fear is that Wimbledon is loudly and clearly sending the opposite message. I intend to do everything I can until Billie Jean's original dream of equality is made real. It's a shame that the name of the greatest tournament in tennis, an event that should be a positive symbol for the sport, is tarnished. And those are incredibly powerful words. They ended up being used in Parliament during a government debate on the topic, which received the backing first of Tessa Jowell, who's the Culture Secretary. She was particularly proactive and important in getting the London Olympic bid off the ground and bringing the Olympics to London. And the then Prime Minister, Tony Blair, got behind it as well. And then in 2007, finally, for the first time, Wimbledon awarded equal prize money to women. And it was Venus Williams lifting her fourth trophy that became the first woman to collect equal prize money. And that is so, so perfect.
Wow. That's, you know, I read all of this at the time, obviously, but I haven't read it since, or at least recently. That was really something to listen to. I think I tend to forget just how important she was in that process. And yeah, I mean, Billie Jean King and many others have been responsible for taking on the fight for so many years, but Venus picked up the baton there. And when she was at her most relevant, her most powerful, and couldn't be ignored and refused to be ignored. That was the beauty of it. She was just not having it. And wow, that's great.
But she did it. You're absolutely right. She just wasn't having it. And she was stubborn and obstinate and knew she was right and refused to lay down. But she did it in the most calm, dignified, serene way. And that's such an inspiring example, because, you know, I find myself too often getting angry and frustrated and just saying, oh, to hell with it all. If people can't see sense, then why is it my responsibility to try and persuade them? And it's so frustrating. It's hard to keep that calmness and that dignity about you sometimes. And she has always been such an exemplary symbol of all of that. And it's really quite inspiring.
I think Venus and Billie Jean King and others who built the WTA Tour and have all played their part in getting equal prize money at the slams, they're all kind of a living history lesson. You know, we're not fully aware yet of their legacy, probably still, because they're still around and they're still playing and they're still influencing. And I think with time, we will really see just how important they all were. I think people are aware, obviously, of how important Billie Jean King is, but someone like Venus Williams, because, you know, it was close. It was close to equal prize money, but it still wasn't equal. And she was the one who said, no, this isn't enough. We need to get this over the line. And I think getting the symbolism of having a completely equal prize money was the last step. And she was the one who was prepared to put herself out there and go and do it. And that idea of her doing it sort of serenely and calmly, that is what I associate with Venus Williams on the court as well. And she's had to be that person because she was a barrier breaker, and she was the first Williams at a time when the tennis world maybe wasn't quite sure whether it was ready for the Williams sisters. So she was the one who had to carry the load. She was the one who had to break through first. And to do that, she had to set an example. And she had to be calm about everything and kind of not show so much emotion. She created the room for Serena to be Serena. But Venus had to sort of cross that bridge first. And I think that's why her celebration at the end of this Wimbledon final in 2005, where you suddenly all her internal emotions are externalized and you see the joy and you see how much it means. She allows herself for once to sort of break out of her stillness and her self-containment, and it all comes out, and it's such a joy to watch.
Serena in her prime is an extraordinary, extraordinary thing. But just aesthetically, on a personal level, if I had to choose a player to watch in their prime, just for sort of aesthetically pleasing purposes, Venus would be right up there on my list of choices, because she's obviously this incredibly athletic figure and just the most wonderful symbol of strength, but the elegance of it all is a sight to behold. I hated the WTA Strong is Beautiful campaign. I thought it was well-intentioned and I saw where they were coming from, but it just made me want to scream at the branding. What does it matter if you're beautiful? You know, it's missed the point, which is that, you know, the world is judging women by their beauty and you're playing into that. But Venus Williams is a symbol of strength being beautiful to me. I mean, she just completely embodies that. It is so beautiful to watch her in full flow. Her movement around the court is so fluid and yet so powerful at the same time. She's extraordinary.
I imagine, Catherine, you can probably also relate to it from somebody who was a figure skater and loves figure skating. I almost look at some of the end position she's in when she's going out wide to a ball and think of a figure skater landing, you know, this ability to just on one leg be able to stop and go and maintain balance.
She'd have been an extraordinary figure skater. She would have been able to dig out landings even when her jumps were completely off axis. That's actually, I'm annoyed I didn't think of that analogy, David, because it's very, very good.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
Her ability to hit winners, not just winners, but redirecting winners when completely off balance, when her weight is going backwards, is something the game had never seen before, particularly on the backhand side. I mean, her backhand was a different shot to any backhand that had been seen before. Had there been an open stance backhand in tennis? I'm not sure that there had. Obviously, Serena ended up coming along with the same backhand, but the way she could dig out clean winners from a completely off balance position on that wing was extraordinary.
Yeah, I can't think of anything comparable, really. And the you mentioned the moment of victory and the reaction. We've never seen anything quite like that either, that I can think of. Not at Wimbledon. We've seen people fall to the ground and be in ecstasy in that way. But the only other person that it reminds me of at all is Angelique Kerber winning her first Grand Slam at the Australian Open, of just being delirious in happiness, in joy, to the point where Venus is just laughing hysterically at the whole situation of how deep she's had to dig, how joyful and wonderful the moment is of victory. It's just wonderful.
Because so often I think the emotions in that moment of victory are really quite complicated, aren't they? I think relief is quite a complicating emotion in that moment. It's completely understandable, but it kind of mixes and meddles with your other emotions to taint them a little bit, perhaps. But champions that had no expectation of winning before the tournament, for whom it's all kind of a bonus, there is a purity often about their emotions in that moment of victory, which is just magnetic. And I think that's exactly what you see from Venus in that moment, because, yeah, she might have thought that she would win more Wimbledons, but I don't think she thought she was going to win that Wimbledon.
I always think there's something special about whenever Venus wins, because I just think of her as the selfless, protective one. And when she gets her own moment to step into the light, and she just grabs it. I always think of that 2017 season when Serena was out on maternity leave. That was a year when Venus stepped up. It was almost like, okay, now this is my time now. And I don't know, there haven't been so many moments like that. Obviously, I love watching Serena play, and having watched Serena win so much has been a captivating story. But there's always been just something a bit different about when it's Venus. Certainly by this stage, I think when they were both breaking through at the same time, But now it had become clear that Serena was the better one and was going to end up winning more. So for Venus to have these moments just were always extra special, I think.
And of course, Lindsay Davenport played an enormous part in that final, and it you know, inevitably is one of the most heartbreaking losses of her career, especially given how brilliantly she played. And I interviewed Lindsay a few weeks ago. We are going to run the interview in full in a couple of weeks, because she's just an absolute joy, isn't she? She's such a normal, relatable person, but that just also happens to be a former world number one and multiple Grand Slam champion. But she really does have a very magnetic personality, really, someone you just sort of enjoy chatting to. And her reflections on this 2005 final were fascinating. Here she is.
You know, it was maybe the only, and I don't want to say it like that, but one of the few matches that I played so well and lost. it was amazing. It was heartbreaking, but it was how to play Venus on grass, and I could never solve that. I could beat her on the other surfaces, but playing her on grass was a totally different challenge. And I served for the match in the second set. I think she broke me at love or 15. I didn't get close. I had a breakup in the third, and that's where I kind of lost it. I had match point at 5-4 or 6-5 returning, but I was up a break earlier in the third, and that's kind of where things got away from me. But you know, I really wanted to win a major, married, and I'd lost in the finals earlier that year at the Australian Open, just completely ran out of gas between the doubles final and the singles final, lost in three sets to Serena. And then I had another chance at Wimbledon and wasn't able to do it. So that part was hard. I wanted to win one as like Mrs. Leach, and I, you know, that's what I was kind of most disappointed at. I wasn't able to win one kind of with my husband there.
What was different about Venus on grass?
That's, you know, I felt like she played even a different style on grass. And I always wondered why she didn't kind of incorporate that onto the hard courts, certainly the faster hard courts. I feel like she should have an Australian Open title. She was way too good of a player, too good of a hard court player to never win there. I think she probably could have won more US Opens. I always felt that though she waited a little bit longer on hard courts, like she wouldn't step into the court, take a ball and start moving forward. It was so tough to get a ball by her on grass, because she would come take balls a little bit earlier. She wasn't afraid to come in. Her ball, she hits very flat, so it kind of skid off that grass that was still playing pretty fast back then. And you're just kind of on your heels. And now you had someone coming forward. The players had stopped really moving forward kind of around that time. But here came Venus, who knew where to cover, did well covering the net. And so you didn't have a lot of breathing room. I still think it was tough to pass her on hard court. I don't think she took advantage of that kind of play and that kind of mindset, being that aggressive, taking any ball a little bit earlier inside the baseline as well on hard courts as she did on grass.
That 05 Wimbledon final was delayed, wasn't it? Because at the conclusion of the men's semi-final that had been rained off the day before. So you had a not before time for your final. Is that right?
Is that right? Oh my gosh, that's a good memory.
I mean, I was going to ask, did that bother you? But the fact that you don't remember it, maybe not. I mean, that seems crazy to me that you'd have a not before time and it would only happen to women.
You know, I don't remember that. I know in 99, we played Sunday and we had a noon start because the men, you know, there was so much rain. I remember that pretty clearly. I don't remember 05, I have to say. I don't remember that at all, but it I'm sure that is likely. I mean, we, you know, with no roofs back then and rain all the time, I feel like we had to be much more flexible than the players have to be these days with more options at the majors with covered courts.
The last point I wanted to make about that match was I read a couple of quotes from you afterwards where you were talking about how during the match you were aware of how good it was, of how exhilarating it was, which is kind of amazing to me because so many players talk about, you know, being present and in the moment. It's like you had this perspective on it, like you were kind of outside of yourself, which is So interesting.
Which probably isn't what you're supposed to be in a Grand Slam final thinking about, wow, this is really good high level. Maybe just a glimpse to the demons in my own mind when I have to go to focus. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, it was, you get a sense when you're playing certain matches, like, okay, this is special. Okay, this is pretty fun. It was amazing for me to be able to, as you said, almost 3 hours to play at a pretty high level until the very end, when all of a sudden I was like, oh my gosh, I can't anymore because my body is now breaking down. But Venus was, you know, she was so good on that court, and she was able to play at levels, you know. Also Venus, you can never tell if she was down on herself or not. I mean, she had this ability to just kind of keep her composure, keep fighting. She is an amazing competitor. And I think that gets kind of underestimated with her because we don't see her give fist pumps. We don't see her kind of get either too excited or too down on herself. And so when you played her, you never really knew what was going on in her mind. She had such a great poker face out there. And you think like, okay, I have the upper hand, and she'd come right back. And in that match, it was very evident because a lot of players would have shown some frustration, would have shown some emotion, and not Venus. She's able to keep it in until the very last point. And I mean, it's impossible not to admire that about her.
So true, isn't it? I think it's really easy to underestimate the competitor in Venus Williams, particularly back then. And I say that because it was her 40th birthday last month, and there were a number of articles to mark that. She did one or two interviews, and she actually was asked on CBS in the States around the time of her birthday what advice her 40-year-old self would have for her 20-year-old self. And Venus replied, I think my 20-year-old self would give some advice to me, actually. Honestly, she was killer. I watched some of those films and my face was unbelievable. You could see the killer instinct. So maybe my 20-year-old self needs to give me some advice. But I'm grateful for every single year.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's what a great find. And actually, I've been thinking about her career and I think that is quite significant in terms of what she didn't do in her career, which when I look at how good she was and how long she's been playing, 7 Grand Slam singles titles doesn't feel enough to me. It feels like she could have won more. Now, obviously, there are very many other great players, Serena being the obvious example of somebody who's won 3 times as many as she has. And there are other players that have justly won their own Grand Slams. Justine Henin has won several, and Capriati won a couple, etc. But I still watch the match that we've just seen and think to myself, how come Venus Williams has not won more? Now, obviously, she's had Sjogren's syndrome, which has caused her a lot of problems in the latter part of her career. She's had other injuries. She's had other life events that have caused problems for her. The way I look at it, I do think that the killer instinct that she describes there probably waned as the years went on, that she didn't have this desire just to win at all costs, that if she didn't win, that she wouldn't be happy, or she wouldn't be feeling as though she's contributing to what her legacy would be and to what her purpose would be. And I think that the 10 minutes of this show that you've described some of her other activity as a tennis player, particularly the achievement she's had in regard to equal prize money, that is her legacy just as much as anything she's done on the court. And so I do think that those are quite prescient words that she said there. But I also feel like, could she have won more? Maybe, but who cares?
Well, I would have liked to see her win more, but yeah, sure.
But I don't care.
No,
I
it
sort
does.
Of
you're
look
right.
Back
it
on
doesn't.
Her career.
If she were a 9-time Grand Slam champion, that wouldn't have a significant impact on her legacy or how she is looked back upon by the tennis world. And you're absolutely right, nor should it. I would love her to have a career slam. I'd love her to have a French and an Australian Open. And it's funny, she says she, again, in an article, I think on the WTA website, to mark her 40th birthday, she was asked about goals, you know, and she said, look, in order to keep playing, should I keep playing because I love tennis, but I have to have goals. You know, that is the nature of sport. You have to have something that you're striving for. And she said, of course, my goals are to win an Australian and a French Open. Why wouldn't I want that? Those are the obvious targets for me. Now, I think she would be the first to recognize that's now unlikely. I think she's outside the world's top 60 at the moment. Who knows how this period off will have affected her. I mean, it could be to her benefit, but, you know, so many unknowns. But I love that she's aware of that and setting that as her goals. I don't know, it just made me smile. Because I don't think she's going to win those. But I like that she wants to.
Something else that made me smile was Davenport talking about how she knew it was a good match during the match. Because I think what this relived has shown me is that it doesn't really matter. I mean, there's that cliche in sport, it doesn't matter how you win, which I think maybe we all slightly disagree with, because we've talked about how much we appreciate players winning with style or with joy. But ultimately, if you win, you're in the record books. But what I think I've learned is that it does matter how you lose. And I think Davenport in this match gave everything and was part of something really special with this match, which she can look back on, okay, not as a win, but as a really important moment in her career. And I think she probably elevated herself in lots of people's minds this day with this performance in the Wimbledon final, even though she didn't win. And I think that's kind of what sport should be about, really. It's giving your all, and you either win or you lose. But at least if you can say that you have given your all and you're appreciative of the moment, there's some satisfaction to be taken from that as well. And it feels like Davenport's got that from this match.
She also had one of the all-time great altercations with an umpire that match.
Yes, where is it? It's in the second set, I think.
Yes, second set. So it's all on a knife. I mean, it's on a knife edge throughout, but...
Yeah, and Venus hits a serve, which is a good 6 inches out.
Wide. Well, nobody even moves, do they? Yeah. Because they're just assuming the call will come.
And there's no call, and it's put down as an ace. And Davenport very calmly just goes up to the umpire, Jerry Armstrong, and says, if I did my job this poorly, I wouldn't be able to be on the court. which is such a damning line, but also just perfect the way she says it, so calm, and then she says, you must try harder.
And I love that.
And I mean, she is right. I mean, either the line judge or the umpire had to be calling that out. It was so far out, and yet she didn't let it affect her tennis, because I think it's around the stage where she goes on to break Venus to serve for the match in the second set. But yeah, just a perfect example of how to deal with those, just how to put your point across in a way that doesn't make you come across badly at all, and yet gets it known that you're not happy with what's gone on.
I'm going to go and practice my disappointed expression with the words, you have to do better.
I think you've got it down, Catherine, to be honest. We were 2 years shy of Hawkeye being used on the court at that point. And it's one of those where TV is using it as well. So by that point, we're getting the replay.
But they didn't bother with the replay. Oh, yeah, they did. But, I mean, it was completely irrelevant, because
the ball was – they were struggling to get the ball and the line in the same shot.
It was so far out. Served down the tee, and there wasn't any spin on it or anything, there was no stage in the ball's flight at which it was ever going in. It wasn't a difficult call. It wasn't sort of spinning or looping or tricking the eye. It was always about a foot out.
I have to say, I think I would make mistakes like that if I was a Lion umpire, because I don't think I could concentrate at all. on the job.
I would suggest you're ineligible for the job then, David.
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't get on. I would be like Lindsay said. I wouldn't be allowed on the course because there's no chance that my mind wouldn't wander and start thinking about something else I could be doing.
Especially that middle line judge actually on a serve whose only job it is to call the serves down the tee. I think I can imagine that their mind would wander in and out quite a lot.
Yeah, at some lower budget tournaments, those centre service line judges have to do a shuffle over to the one of the sidelines, yeah. Don't they, to cover that during the points, which always feels pretty on the edge to me. But you know,
would you like my Cecil Karatansheva postscript?
Yes,
sure. We've all pronounced that name completely differently amongst ourselves.
I think it's Karatansheva. So I've just done it wrong as well. So her comments about Sharapova came at Indian Wells, I think 2004. She played her, won the first set, Sharapova beat her in three. Then they played at Wimbledon the year after in 2005. And the headline of the article in The Guardian is Sharapova rewards insult with a good kicking. It was 6-love, 6-1.
Ooh.
Oh,
and Karatansheva is refusing to back down in the post-match. She says, I really don't regret saying those things. I meant what I said, and I'm not sorry. Who knows? Maybe I'll say it again sometime. She was 15. She's still playing today. She tried to qualify for Wimbledon and the Australian Open last year.
Right, as a 30-year-old or a 29-year-old then. Wow.
30-year-old, yeah.
Right, well, that was your Lindsay Davenport Venus Williams podcast with a side helping of Cecil Karatansheva.
We didn't even get to talk about spotting Tim from The Office in the crowd.
Yes, Martin Freeman inexplicably was on the front row, sat behind Lindsay Davenport's left shoulder.
Not that Catherine believed me when I saw it.
Well,
almost
happened. Don't start this again.
I did not believe you. I was just seeking further confirmation.
I could have kept my mouth shut as well.
And Gavin Rossdale was in Lindsay Davenport's box. So it was a real smattering of slightly random. Although he wasn't random, he was a total tennis groupie around that time, wasn't he? In fact, lovely segue coming up. wasn't he also in the box for the match that we're covering tomorrow?
He was. He was in Roger Federer's box against Rafael Nadal. We're there. The 2008 men's final is coming up tomorrow.
It's coming up tomorrow. So clear your schedule.
I've just looked on YouTube, and the full match on YouTube is 6 hours and 13 minutes long.
Have they included the rain delays?
I think there might be a bit of sort of, you know, ceremony before and after, because I think the match is 5 hours something.
We need one of those edits. I can't remember what match it was during the French Open. There was an edit that cut out all ball bouncing.
Yeah, it was
walking between.
It was Chang Edberg. Oh. It was in 12 parts.
It was so great. I mean, it was literally just balls hitting rackets.
I calculate that I can watch that 3.5 times before we record tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Awesome.
But you've got to allow time for several rewatches of the last two games of Ivanisevic Rafter in there as well, because he's still doing
that.
Yesterday, he went off on an Agassi-Becker tangent. What were you watching?
Agassi-Sampras, 1993, 5 sets.
I had to tell him he was watching the wrong match. He's stuck in the 90s, David. that was what we think is the greatest women's final of all time, I think. Most people would probably agree that where we're going tomorrow is the greatest men's final of all time. So things are kicking up a notch here on Wimbledon Relived. I've noticed this morning on Gerald's Instagram that he's been posing with some champagne. He's really getting big for his boots. I'm worried about it.
I've got an interesting chat going with Gerald's account. So it's like we're talking to Gerald on there.
I thought you were going to say Gerald's accountant.
I think it's probably Daryl who is sending the messages. But
is Gerald like telling you to go through his agent?
But he just says you've no idea how hard it is to get these photo shoots done. There's a lot of resistance on Gerald's part.
Well, we're very grateful. There is nothing I love more than tennis plus animal content. It's the best. So thank you, Gerald, for being our mascot. Thank you, David. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Lindsay Davenport, for your contribution to that episode. Thanks to all our guests. Tomorrow, it's 2008, Federer and Nadal. We'll see you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.